1322-147 CR, Debrett Montreal Black versus the State of Texas.
Good morning. I appreciate this time before this court, as we have been transferred from the 10th Court of Appeals to this honorable court. I bring three arguments before this court for Mr. Black: that the trial court erred in denying the self-defense instruction, that the trial court failed to adequately control the courtroom atmosphere by allowing the presence and continued presence of uniformed law enforcement, and that the trial court erred in failing to exclude testimony of several law enforcement officers who had not complied with the statutory duty to turn over or certify that they had turned over evidence to the prosecution. On the first issue, Your Honor, on self-defense, I'm going to go through it in the manner of answering some of the state's concerns and address any questions that the court may have. But the state's first argument was, well, it's waived. The requested instruction did not comport with that given the requested instruction did not comport with the objection. And that's not the way the law works. The Court of Criminal Appeals has held repeatedly that a request for a jury instruction need not be in perfect form. It need only be sufficient to call the attention to the trial court's omission in the jury charge. So that's simply a specious argument. The real question is whether Mr. Black was entitled to that instruction. And I don't think either of the two parties here debate on the applicable law. It's purely statutory. It's been fleshed out over centuries and decades of this state's common law. The real question is whether there was sufficient evidence to produce or require the trial court to produce the instruction. And what the state said, there must be something.
I would like to spend just a little time on the statute itself, because I want to make sure that we understand precisely which provision you are relying on, because in your brief you cite to 9.32A1 and 2A, and at trial it appears your argument was on 9.31, although you do cite to 9.31 as well. But which part of the statute are you arguing specifically applies here with the facts and the circumstances?
The use of deadly force in any situation, that basically if the court is addressing the confusion over whether it was allowed under the arrest, I'm going to address that in a minute. But basically, there's a statutory right to a lawful use. There's a lawful use of self-defense and deadly force when there is danger created in the mind of that defendant to be able to use deadly force. It's simply.
And so that would be, are you reciting to 9.32?
I would. At that point? Yes. I don't have the code in front of me, but I believe that would be the applicable.
Okay, but because 9.321 says that it would apply if it was justified in using force against the other under 9.31. So that's where we begin. And I have a question as to how 9.31 applies to these circumstances here, given the list. If you don't have the statute in front of you, there
right.
are.
So I get what I'm interpreting that court is whether he was entitled to self-defense at all. Whether deadly force is not the question, whether he was entitled to self-defense at all.
Correct.
Okay. Well, and that's the question. And first, the state basically argues that, well, it was an execution, therefore the laws of self-defense don't apply. But that's simply not the case. He's entitled to an instruction on any defensive issue, whether it's raised by the evidence, weak or strong, unimpeached, contradicted in the trial court's opinion of the credibility of the defense. And that's the key part of all of this. The trial court basically required a different standard for defense against peace officers, and because it was a capital murder case, that we required extra evidence. That's simply not the case. It's solely required that a scintilla of evidence to produce the necessity of the charge is the issue. And I think in answer to the court's direct question here, it's apparent danger. The danger need not be real. But if I'm defending against some apparition and I reasonably apprehend that, then basically I'm entitled to a self-defense instruction and therefore, under the circumstances in this case, entitled to a deadly force instruction.
Now, except that the state is arguing, and as the trial court seemed to rely on the part of the law that says that the belief had to have been held by an ordinary and prudent man in the same circumstances as the actor. So in the same circumstances as the actor, does that mean that we have to consider Mr. Black's, what is the right word for it, his paranoia, the mental issues that he was suffering from? Are those to be taken into consideration to determine whether this was reasonable for him?
And I think in answer to that, I can provide you the state's argument that I, as an appellant, argued that we're arguing that a reasonable person in this matter is an African-American Army combat veteran with PTSD, anxiety, and other mental health issues. That's simply not the issue. The issue is whether it's a question of law or question of fact, and whether a defendant has a reasonable belief to the use of self-defense is a question of fact for the jury. And certainly I did not argue that standard as the state tries to pigeonhole the defense or the appellant into. That's not the applicable fact, and certainly I don't believe that it's supportable by law that this court can take into account Mr. Black's individual proclivities. What we are arguing is, however, that a part of that reasonable man view is his perception as he presented that a Black man in that situation might believe that deadly force was going to be used by the police in that instance, and that provided the scintilla of evidence to provide for a self-defense instruction in this matter, and also the use of deadly force. Now, the record is lengthy, and the matter was well tried by all sides. But in the record, Mr. Black is arrested and is taken back to the police department and begins rambling about his motivations for shooting the police officer. Within that statement, it can be divined that he saw the second police car, and that second police car is what made it appear to him that imminent deadly force may come from the police. That viewpoint was supported in appellant's brief by social scientists. This properly raised the issue for self-defense. And we would argue that
I do need to jump back on the preservation issue, because as the state has argued, your requested instruction made absolutely no mention whatsoever of this other officer, of Trooper Poole, the patrol car approaching. It simply focuses on Officer Allen's conduct. So isn't there a problem there with the preservation of this request?
No, it's simply basic. The law surrounding that, as I understand it, is that if I raise the issue of self-defense and I raise further the issue of deadly force, that apprises the court of my complaint. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to have the magical language. I don't have to have this. I don't have to have that. All I have to do is say, I'm looking for a self-defense instruction. That self-defense instruction should include deadly force. You, as the trial court has the ultimate duty in that matter to confirm the accuracy and that it conforms to law. It is not
a case. Had the trial court accepted your requested instruction, the jury would have been focusing on Officer Allen's conduct as to whether it was reasonable for Mr. Black to have reacted in the way that he did. And the jury would not have considered anything about the other officer or the approaching vehicle.
I agree potentially with the argument put forth by the state. It's not a preservation issue, as the trial court has the ultimate duty to conform the charge to the law. The trial court could have foreseen this evidence, should have foreseen this evidence, and the charge as given. The appellant only needed to put the state or put the trial court on notice that it required a self-defense instruction, and that self-defense instruction should have been deadly force. The remainder of it, I think, is specious.
Okay, let me ask you about the harm in this case. However, you've argued that it's some harm is all that has to be shown. Is the mere denial of this requested instruction enough to show some harm?
That is absolutely, according to the Court of Criminal Appeals, that is the correct answer. The state cites a case that I call an elevator case. It went up to the went up to Texarkana, went back down, got sent back down by the Court of Criminal Appeals, went back up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and was improvidently granted. Throughout that, the case of Reich Bockott is the case that the state cites for the harm analysis, and I believe that a harm analysis is proper, but that train has left the station. In Rogers versus State at 550 Southwest 3rd 190, a 2018 Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that the failure to provide the jury with the only defensive issue that it had was calculated to injure the rights of the defendant. Without that instruction in this case, there was but one answer to the jury in this case. Certainly, you cannot argue, or the defense could not argue, that he was not culpable in this matter, in that he had a confession. But the defense itself, as a Court of Criminal Appeals said, is sufficient. And that's been followed by a couple of other Court of Appeals, which I cited in appellant's brief. So I believe the harm analysis is, again, a non-issue, that basically the mere failure of presentation of the defense is sufficient harm and requires remand in this case. I want to touch on one more state's argument, and that's concerning whether Mr. Black was under arrest. The statute cited is the 1965 Code of Criminal Procedure definition of arrest. That's been set aside by United States Supreme Court and Court of Criminal Appeals opinions, in that they have had to incorporate the then establishing or the definition of reasonable suspicion and the Terry stop issues. The 1965 statute does not take that into account. The issue of whether Mr. Black was under arrest had already been covered by the state's footnote in stating that they had not conducted an arrest. I would like, with my remaining time, to argue concerning issue two, the uniformed presence of the trial office, the officers.
Yeah, I was going to jump to that, in fact, and because the state has argued that you have failed to show any, that their presence, first, that their presence were really few in number, and that you have not shown actual prejudice.
And the state has a wonderful argument in that manner, in that I'm unable to show harm under 606B of the rules of evidence. I'm simply confined. I can't do that. And I cannot imagine a more coercive atmosphere of having one of your own who is the victim of an offense and let's recall that the witness got up, that pulled up on the scene, was very emotional, and then having 4 to 5 uniformed officers outside in the gallery, I find that sufficiently coercive.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Schwieger, you're out of time, but you will have your remaining minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Tanner.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to start off where we've just stopped, since it was just addressed as it relates to point of error number 2, the presence of law enforcement officers. And I think that's what's really significant here is that counsel talks about, yes, there were 4 or 5 officers there, but the record is clear that the trial court regularly, when it was brought up that there were a number of officers present, the court noted that they were greatly outnumbered by people in civilian clothes, that the most that were present were one day, possibly 6, 4 or 5, and each time there was 3, 4, 5 more times civilians. So the mere fact of them being there is not by itself coercive. And the court is right. We are not able to show there. We're not here saying there was he was required to show actual prejudice. There is the whole area of inherent prejudice. And there is no inherent prejudice in it here either. There is nothing in the record to suggest that the officers did any of the things that were troubling to the various courts that have addressed this issue before. They did not sit in a block. They did not sit by the jury. They did not sit on the front row. There was just officers there. And I think it was really significant, the Ramirez case that the state cited. This is a California case, but it involved up to 17, 18, 20 officers in the courtroom. And in that case, the court noted, of course, officers want to come watch. Of course, officers want to be there to support their colleague. That in and of itself is not coercive. And so when you look at this record in its totality, the trial court was clear that it was not going to allow or tolerate any sort of disruptions by officers. The trial court specifically said, I will not allow placards. I will not allow pictures of Damon Allen. I will not allow anything that could disrupt this. And the defense, at trial, the defense provided the trial court absolutely nothing to suggest that it was disruptive. And in fact, each time they brought it up, if there had been something disruptive, the court would have addressed it. And so the mere fact of 4 or 5 officers there is certainly not the inherent prejudice that would cause a jury to go from a state of non-persuasion to persuasion. And in particular, as it relates to that point of error, the harmless error is so clear, because even if the trial court was wrong in not restricting the officers, there is just simply no way this could have been harmful, because there is no way the jury could have been in a state of non-persuasion with the evidence that was presented to them. It was utterly irrefutable. And so I would ask if the court has any questions on point of error 2. I'm happy to answer them, but without any, I'll move forward to the point of error number 1.
I don't believe there are any questions at this time on that issue.
Thank you. As it relates to the first point of error, counsel for the defense, for the appellant talks extensively about the idea that it is from the defendant's standpoint, the determination of whether there was a reasonable apprehension of danger from the officers. And he's right about that. It is from the defendant's standpoint, but not from his standpoint, from a psychological standpoint. It is from the standpoint of a reasonable and ordinary person on the side of the road on I-45 in the middle of the day on Thanksgiving Day. And the state has cited to numerous cases where the courts, the Court of Criminal Appeals, and other courts in this state have specifically said that in a determination of whether a belief is a reasonable belief, whether it is a belief that would be held by a reasonable and ordinary prudent person, the particular psychological peculiarities of that individual defendant are not relevant. In the Echavarria case.
But shouldn't it be up to the jury to determine whether it's credible, whether it's reasonable for a person to believe as he or she did?
In many of the cases that the state cited, that the fact that it was considered by the trial court not to be reasonable because it wouldn't have been a belief held by an ordinary and prudent person, the trial court did not allow the jury to have a self-defense instruction. And that was held to be proper because it's the trial court that's a gatekeeper of determining whether the belief was reasonable, was that of a reasonable person, and was that of an ordinary and prudent person. If the trial court comes to that gatekeeping decision, then it is appropriate for the trial court to keep it out. And in that regard, I would cite to the, as we did in the brief, the Echavarria case, where the court said, it's not the perspective of a trained Marine and how he would see the threats, just like this defendant. In the Werner case, it wasn't the perspective of somebody who had Holocaust syndrome. In the Tucker case, it wasn't the perspective of somebody who was a psychopath or a sociopath. And there's a case that I think is very important on this exact point that we bandied about tremendously during the trial itself, and that is the state or Randall Mays case, Mays versus State. And the site on that is 318 Southwest 3rd, 368. I did not cite to it in my brief, which frankly, as I went back in the last day or two, I was surprised that I had not, because it is so relevant to so many things. But we talked a lot about it at trial on the issue of
dementia. You said 318 Southwest 3rd, 368?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's a spelled M-A-Y-S. Okay.
And we talked a great deal about it at trial as it related to the issue of diminished capacity. But there's a very important point in that case that bears mentioning here. And in that case, that defendant had shot two police officers, and he wanted to have the jury instructed on the issue of self-defense because he had a belief that these officers were threatening him. And there was a great deal of testimony that came in about his mental health and his mental difficulties and many things like that. And in that case, the Court of Criminal Appeals specifically said, and I quote, "Texas law does not recognize the ordinary and prudent paranoid psychotic for purposes of penal code justification defenses." That tells us right there that this defendant's particular psychological peculiarities do not factor into the analysis. The question is whether a reasonable person would have decided in the middle of the afternoon that they should open fire on a police officer who's driving because another officer's driving up, a person who incidentally has active warrants. But more to the point as well, I was stricken by counsel's brief and counsel's argument today that there has been no discussion of Penal Code 9.31B, the exceptions to the right of self-defense. And 9.31B2 makes a specific exception that says that you do not have a right to self-defense to resist an arrest unless one of two things are present. Number one, that ties in subsection C as well. Either A, that the person did not know he was a law enforcement officer. Obviously, we don't have that here. There was no dispute whatsoever that this defendant knew Damon Allen was a peace officer and he was pulled over by a peace officer. So that is not one of the things that was present here. Or secondly, that the officer used greater force than was necessary to effectuate the arrest. Well, as we've discussed extensively in our brief, there was no force. There was no physical force. Damon Allen was sitting in his car and Trooper Poole was driving up to assist him. There was no force. So because of the fact that neither of those factors is present, the right of self-defense at all simply does not apply. And so all of this discussion of whether he's entitled to the charge or not should be summarily taken care of by 9.31 B and C, along with 9.32 as it relates to the deadly force aspect of it. And I think there's another case that, again, I wish I'd have found before I wrote my brief, but I found it since then, and that is the Zwack case, Zwack, Z-W-A-C-K, 757 Southwest 2nd 66. That case was factually very, very similar to this case, frighteningly so. It was a case in which that particular defendant had been placed on probation, and it was learned after he was placed on probation that he had a weapon. And so an officer attempted to effectuate a stop on him. Two officers came up, and he immediately got out of his car and he opened fire on the officers. I believe it, the opinion said he shot 27 times with a semi-automatic rifle. So again, very, very similar. He struck one officer, but fortunately that officer lived. And that defendant, through the course of the evidence, it was revealed that he suffered under a paranoid delusion that he was being ambushed by police officers who intended to kill him, not just arrest him. There was evidence that he had very negative feelings about the police. He was felt very fearful of them, very scared of them, very angry at them. All of the same kinds of things that came up in this case. His trial attorney asked for an instruction on self-defense. He argued that if the circumstances as perceived by appellant were true, actually true, they would have entitled him to an acquittal on self-defense. So therefore, he should also be entitled to an instruction on self-defense. The 14th Court of Appeals made short work of that argument. And basically what the 14th Court said is that even if the circumstances were as that defendant perceived them to be, even if the officers were attempting to ambush him, which obviously wasn't true, just like it wasn't true in this case, he still would not have been entitled to a charge on self-defense because of the exception to self-defense that is present in 9.31 B and C. The fact that he knew it was an officer and there was no force. And so that tells us right there that.
But what is the petition history on that case?
The petition was refused, Your Honor. So that tells us that without these two things present, even the discussion on apparent danger, and I believe that the discussion on apparent danger tells us right there that the instruction shouldn't come in. But separate and apart from that, the exception to self-defense also tells us that the instruction should not come in. I would also like to address the question of harm, and counsel's right with respect to the fact that there are a lot of cases that talk about that the refusal to provide the only defensive instruction that's out there is harmful. And I do not disagree that most of the times it is harmful. Quite often, the vast majority of time, it's harmful. But the Reich Bischoff case, and I know that I'm massacring the name, was a case where the only defensive instruction was self-defense. It was denied. It was sent back for a harmless error analysis. And the Court of Appeals, in their harmless error analysis, said that there was no evidence of force on the part of the victim. There was no evidence of any of the things that are required for self-defense. So therefore, how could it possibly be harmful? Because there was nothing that would support self-defense. And so I simply point that out that, yes, it is most often harmful. But in a situation like this, where we have evidence like what we have here, where we have a defendant who, with no force at all inflicted upon him, did what this defendant did, where he executed this officer as he sat in his car, then I believe in this case, with this limited set of circumstances, if the trial court erred, and I do not believe the trial court erred, it would not be harmful. because it wouldn't have gotten.
But before we even get to that question, I still have a question on preservation, because as you all know, law says that when a defensive theory is raised by evidence from any source and a charge is properly requested, it must be submitted to the jury. So you heard the response from appellant's counsel regarding preservation. And so my question is, was the instruction here properly requested?
I think it was proper to request the instruction. And I think they made the request, but the instruction that they asked for was completely inconsistent with the argument that he's later making. It's certainly not the job of the trial court to make evidentiary rulings about what the evidence means, and because I believe that would all be a comment on the evidence. But specifically, he asked for a charge on Damon Allen's use of force. And then he now argues, well, it's Trooper Poole's use of force. Well, the truth of the matter is there's no force from either one. And so I think that in light of that, there is a preservation problem, because the charge that they've asked for doesn't comport with what they're arguing now. And it certainly doesn't comport with what their argument at the time was. Does that answer the court's question?
Yes.
Thank you. And again, I go back to what I believe is the most important thing, which is that all of this is premised on the reasonable man standard. Everything in our self-defense law is premised on the reasonable man standard. And this defendant himself readily admitted that he was not that reasonable man. Ranger Burson, when he talked to him the very night of the offense, he told him, he said, I was not in my right mind and somebody else would have done differently, or words to that effect. I'm paraphrasing. But more importantly, when I talked to him, I talked to the defendant and I asked him, I said, you know, you've told us about your PTSD, you've told us about all of these things, and surely you'll agree with me that those all caused you to see this differently than an ordinary reasonable person would. And he agreed with me that it would. And then I specifically asked him, so surely you'll agree that somebody who had not suffered all these things that you've told us about would not have viewed this as a threat. And his answer was, I would hope they would not. So that in and of itself tells you that he's not viewing this as this reasonable man that is contemplated by our self-defense law, that is contemplated by all of the cases where all of the courts, including the Court of Criminal Appeals, has said the reasonable man standard is not of a reasonable psychotic or a reasonable man with PTSD or a reasonable man with anxiety disorder, of all of those things, but a reasonable and ordinary prudent person. And that's the standard. And so with that, the trial court was completely correct in denying the charge. Does the court have other questions about point of error one?
Any questions, judges? No. No, we do not have any questions at this time.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. And with that, unless the court has other questions, we believe that the trial court completely acted appropriately in all three of these areas, and the appellant has provided this court no reason to reverse this judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tanner.
I have the utmost respect for Ms. Tanner. I've tried a case against her. I have now litigated an appeal against her. I have the utmost respect for her of almost every prosecutor in this state.
Thank you.
But she is mischaracterizing what I argued and what I'm before this court on. I in no way indicated at any time that Mr. Black's behavior on that day should be measured as the reasonably mentally ill person. That's not the standard. I did not argue that standard, and it's not applicable here today. What I argued is that his statements that he made during his confession, when parsed, provided sufficient evidence for a reasonable person to exercise his right to self-defense and use of deadly force. That is the argument before the court today. The preservation issue, again, if we look at it, the argument or the presentation of that particular issue by trial counsel was limited to the person, but it was the sight of the other car pulling up that raised Mr. Black's suspicion. So whether it's solely the use of force by the officer, the slain officer, or the second officer is again a specious argument, because that is covered by the request. And once again, the request is not required to be perfect. I want to state, I understand this is a horrible crime. This was horrific for me to review, and it's probably not too pleasant for this court to review. But this state's courts have never said, we toss the rules of evidence, we toss the rules of criminal procedure, we toss the rules out if a law enforcement officer is involved. And I believe the overtones of this, that's exactly what the state is arguing, that basically we're here on a really horrible crime, let's forget everything. And so I wish the court to ensure that we're going to keep the eyes on the ball here. If we're talking about the right to arrest, right to resist arrest, as the state put in their footnote concerning this issue, he wasn't under arrest. It was a traffic stop.
But they did argue that he anticipated he was going to be arrested. I mean, he knew he had outstanding warrants. He was, speeding. And so I'm sure if we're judging him by the reasonable person standard, then it was reasonable for him to know that he was going to be arrested. So then does 9.31B1 and 2, as the state has argued, keep him from being able to assert this self-defense?
I believe the plain language of the statute,
the use of force is not justified.
He was never under arrest. The penal code is clear in its statements. It does not say probable cause to arrest. It does not say reasonable suspicion to pull someone over. It does not say Terry stop.
It says arrest. To resist an arrest.
Right. And so he was never resisting an arrest, because an arrest had not been consummated at that point.
Okay. We'll have to probably research that a bit more.
All right. Well, Your Honors, let me just conclude. Again, I would argue on behalf of Mr. Black that this court examine all of the issues, that it look at this matter as it would with anything, rather than the horrific nature of the offense, and ask that this court reverse this case and remand it for a new trial.
We will. I assure you, we will consider these issues very seriously. So the case will be under submission.